Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I got a brother. This is my friend. I just got to know him recently. That's my boy right here. We're going to talk. We're going to talk about his journey. We're going to talk about just everything. I have such a deep respect for this man. This is Tim Banks.
Hey, everybody. I'm Tim Banks, Principal Solutions Architect with Equinix Metal. Dan, I'm glad to be here, man. We've talked. We've gotten to know you. I'm a fan. Like, and it's not like a fanboy, like, oh my gosh, you know, like what's going to, I like meeting LeBron James or something like that, which, you know, but it's cool to like see somebody, meet somebody, see their work, respect their work, and get to respect them as a person. And I think that's important, right? You know, and if there's one thing that I really learned from the, you know, pandemic and isolation, all that kind of stuff like that, it's that, you know, the people matter, not just their work, but the actual people matters way more than the work.
No doubt.
So yeah, I'm stoked to be here.
Dude, again, mutual respect. So let's talk about your journey, because again, it's such a freaking interesting journey. Talk to me about your beginnings, even before tech and then getting into tech, right?
Oh man. So let's go back to, high school, right? We'll start there. So in high school, I was in band. I was a band nerd, marching band, jazz band, wind ensemble. I was first chair all-state bass clarinet, you know, all city and regional jazz band. And
jazz band right here, dude.
See,
jazz
band. See, so I played tenor sax and jazz band. Here was the problem. I was pretty doggone good at tenor sax, right? The problem is that I went to high school with a kid at the time named Chad Hugo, right? So Chad Hugo now is a producer and musician in a group called NERD, along with one Mr. Pharrell Williams, who also grew up in the same time as high school I was at. Not the same high school, but the same time when I was in high school, but at a rival high school. So I knew both of these cats, and they were kids, and they were like, wow, they're really good. But Chad, being such a phenomenal musician, was the reason I was always second chair tenor sax. No matter how good I got, no matter how long I practiced, man, it didn't matter, because Chad Hugo was always better than I was. I didn't even become first chair to my senior year because he was a year older than me. And I was like, finally. But here's
where was this, Tim?
Kempsville High School, Virginia Beach, right?
Okay.
And so here's why that's important. I mentioned this so I can carry it forward, is because it very early on told me that no, doesn't matter how good you are, right? Somebody out there is better than you are. And like, that was an important lesson learned, right? The other thing the band is, it taught me, like, you know, discipline and how to march and how to stand still and how to be uncomfortable, right? In marching band, because I played percussion in marching band, and, you know, drums are heavy, right? People yell at you and you do stuff. And so,
Can we talk about that? Do you think, again, we'll get into this, but you think, like, yeah, as a technical person, it seems like a lot of technical folks like have like a musician background, like, it's, mm-hmm, you know, it's, do you think it's just the repetition aspect of it? Like, what are the factors, like, the, you know, from that perspective?
There's a few aspects of it, and several of them carry forward. Number one, that, yeah, there's a repetition. There's an application of technique, right? So all music is math. It's all math, right? Rhythm is math. You know, the notes are math. And all you're doing is reassembling the same in you know, modern, like, you know, Western music, same, what, 12 tones, 12 recognized tones in a different order for different amounts of time. That's it. It's your option. You got 12 tones. And so every musical piece that you've heard, right, that is Western, it's all 12 tones distributed around different things like that. So that's a lot like development, right? You've got your syntax, obviously more than 12 things, but you got your syntax, you got your function, all that kind of stuff. And now you're just rearranging them to make things happen. That's all music is, right? So you can look at a score like a program, you know, and then a symphony is a compiler.
So you think that prepared you for that, you know, that next step? And we talk about something. Isn't trap music from Virginia Beach? Did I get that right?
Yeah, kind of somewhat. Look, I didn't come here for you to yell at me, okay?
I'm just asking, man.
Yeah, it's really East Coast. Well, we'll say East Coast, right?
Okay.
But here's the other important thing about being a musician, right? It's teamwork, right? Is that your whatever little thing you do is not the most important thing, right? If you're a French horn player, you know what note you played. It was the upbeat, right? But right, that was it. If you're French horn, that's what you did. You play the pa, right? You were never you're always pa. But that was important, right? Your little pa was what made the march go, right? Even though you got boring, if you ever played it by yourself, you know, you can't play that for your family when they go, oh, play me a tune, right? You're just going to go like pa, 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 pa. It's like four notes for like, you know, for 128 measures, right? Nobody's going to be impressed with that, but it's critical. You know, so if your job is to write a GC function, you know, it's not flashy. It's not glorious. It's not going to win you any, you know, any developer of the year awards, but it's critical, right?
Right, no doubt.
And so you bring all these things together and you have to work. You have the conductor who is like, you know, your product manager, project manager. Everyone has their pieces they got to bring in. Everyone's got to be all right on time. And if it doesn't work all together, it's a shit show, right? So tell me that's not modern DevOps.
No doubt. What you build and where it takes you shouldn't be limited by your database. CockroachDB helps developers build and scale apps with fewer obstacles, more freedom, and greater efficiency, so you can forget about the database and trust that it just works. Kubernetes-friendly, open source, and indestructible, CockroachDB makes it easier to build and scale apps. It gives companies the freedom to serve customers anywhere, and it's backed by world-class documentation and excellent dedicated support. Discover CockroachDB, the most highly evolved distributed SQL database on the planet. Kubernetes native and built from the ground up to help companies of all sizes, including Bose, Comcast, and Equifax, scale fast, survive anything, and thrive anywhere. Sign up for a free 30-day trial and get a free t-shirt at cockroachlabs.com/popcast. That's cockroachlabs.com/popcast. So then again, we get the discipline of the marching band, and what happens next?
So my idea was to join the Marine Corps Drum and Bugle Corps, right? I auditioned for the School of Music. I made the School of Music. I made the Marine Corps Drum and Bugle Corps. I went and took the ASVAB, went to boot camp. And then they figured out that my ASVAB scores, which were really, really, really high, would suit me better for their need for avionics techs more than musicians. In the words of the regimental commander, I can find any idiot to go play drums, but we need avionics techs. And so I was switched in boot camp to a different MOS, which you know was what really put me on my path. Like I had a Commodore 64 when I was a kid, wrote some programs, but never thought that like tech was going to be an actual career, right? In the mid 80s, that wasn't what you did. You worked in like big rooms with suits on that were loud. I didn't want any of that, right? But then, you know, this is where we, this is what put me on the path to being, you know, kind of good at tech, right? Because an avionics tech is an electronic, you get basically an associate's degree when you're in A school, right? And so you learn to count binary hexadecimal with a gunnery sergeant yelling in your face, right? So like you can do stuff under pressure that way, right? You're sitting there in a gas mask doing, you know, soldering on microminiature components while things are blowing up around you just as practice, right? Okay, so now when there's a SEV-1 at 2 o'clock in the morning, my pulse doesn't raise. I'm like, okay, whatever. It's not that big a deal, you know? But again,
all of you at home listening to this, if you want to have your folks put on the gas mask and try to do this whole exercise, you never know. You could be just as good as Tim someday.
I wouldn't wish that on anybody, man. So trying to solder on a gas mask is not fun. But like I said, you learn how to do things under just some really horrendous conditions because you may actually have to do that. But, it's again, these are common things. Like all the things that I like to do have common threads. They have teamwork. They have, kind of arranging things in a problem solving, like arranging known things in a way to solve problems. Right. They have dealing with adversity. And they either look cool or taste good, like with food or something like that. Marine Corps had cool uniforms. I got to blow stuff up. That was always fun. Right. You know, it is cool to shoot a machine gun that shoots 40-millimeter grenades, right? Just full stop. If you say, hey, here's a machine gun that shoots 40-millimeter high explosive grenades, that's a good time, right? Tell me you wouldn't do that.
Of course not. Of course I'd be all over that. Everybody. Yeah. Come on, everybody, you know, when you go to Vegas, the first thing you do besides gamble is you go shoot a gun or something. Of course.
Yeah, like, ooh, machine guns. Yeah. Everyone's like in Texas, like, oh, do you have a machine gun? I was like, no, I mean, I could get one, but I have to buy my own ammunition now, so I'm not interested.
Yeah, it's a little rough. Yeah. And so, but, so now we traverse from the, you know, again, the Marine Corps. Tell me about the chef part, because you, again, this guy is the most interesting dude alive. Like, tell me his whole, you know, this progression. I want to talk about that part. Let's talk about that.
So I got out of the Marine Corps. I became a systems administrator for Lockheed Martin, right? And doing, you know, defense contracting, military contracting, that kind of stuff like that, as is kind of normal for people that have a technical background in the military. Then we had the recession after 9/11. There was a bunch of layoffs and I was one of them. And so I went around kind of plunking around, like, you know, tech jobs, whatever I could get, you know, gig jobs, whatever I could get. And then finally, man, I literally burned out. Like, I literally was just sitting there and I realized after like months of just wishing I would get hit by a car on the way to work, so I didn't have to go to work, that this ain't healthy. And I just literally walked over to my supervisor's desk and was like, yeah, I'm going home. And I put my badge on the desk. He's like, oh, you're not feeling well? Like, yeah, but I'm like not coming back. I'm done with this. And then literally left, walked out of a job, right? Went down to the restaurant that I would normally go to from time to time. That's near my house. It's a nicer place. It's called Parallel 36. Was sitting there at lunchtime drinking, as one typically doesn't do, I guess. And the restaurant owner was bartending. He was like, not used to seeing you here this time of day. What's going on? I was like, oh, I just quit my job. It's like, is that good news? I'm like, mom, not necessarily. It's like, well, have you ever worked in a kitchen before? I was like, yeah, I did in high school, side jobs. Like, well, I happen to have an opening for, you know, a salad person, line cook, prep cook back here. If you want something. I was like, I have nothing to lose at this point, because I still had to go home and tell my wife that I had quit my job. So so I did that, and then that went as well as one could ever expect. And then you know, went back to work for Carl Dornan was his name. You know, it was like you know, it's like a you know, fish in water. Like, I had, you know, I already had discipline, right? I was already used to dealing with adverse stuff. I was already used to working on teams. I liked to eat. You know, that was a natural thing where I liked to eat. I liked to cook already, and I could understand the flavor profiles. And so those things combined to make me pretty good in the kitchen. And I could be trusted. I showed up on time. I didn't steal stuff, you know, as is want to happen in kitchens sometimes, and work my way up from prep cook, salad person, to line cook, the grill, to, eventually I ended up becoming a sous chef and then executive chef for the same restaurant owner, at various of his restaurants.
What type of cuisine was it?
So Parallel 36 was a fusion cuisine from everywhere in the world on the 36th parallel. So it was Korean. It was Spanish. It was, other Mediterranean. It was Greek. There was some, you know, Southern Virginian cuisine, which is because 36 parallel is the one that went right through, or almost right through, Norfolk, Virginia.
So you can think about, again, that under pressure thing, right? Look, having to prepare, like, you know, whatever X amounts of cuisine, think about that list. And you probably heard this before, but like, my parents owned restaurants growing up. Right. And so you had to prepare what were the specials and all that fun stuff. I mean, that takes a lot, you know, in terms of preparation, you know, mental duress and all that fun stuff. Like, restaurants are stressful, stressful, you know.
There's something to be said about being, you know, Saturday night at 8:30 in the evening in a restaurant, and you've got 20 tickets hanging, you've got every burner filled up, you've got people yelling, the waiters yelling that they forgot this and they forgot that, they need this, need that. And you are temping different things at one time, trying to figure out exactly, and coordinating with the fry person, with the salad person, with these other people that have to put these parts so that they can go on the plate all at the right time and then get out, right? And not just one plate, the table full of plates all arrive at the same time. And then you have to deal with the fact that the waiter says, oh, I forgot to tell you that they also need this, or we just sub this or sub that. And like, okay, well, now we have to make all these other adjustments, right? That's the routine. That is every day. that is normal every day. You're in that and it's 140 degrees and you're wearing a long sleeve chef coat. You're just sweating buckets into your things and like, you know, going to walk in. You're going back and forth. People have hot stuff. They have sharp stuff. And everybody does this. And in the good kitchens, you're just conversational tone, right? Your pulse isn't up. You're just normal. You're just doing it. The pace increases, but the intensity is always steady in the good kitchens, right? In the bad kitchens, or when somebody's having a bad day, everybody has a bad day, right? And so everyone has to be together. But the other thing is too, is that when somebody's having a bad day, you have to recognize that quick. You have to get in there quick. You have to figure out how you can help do that before it goes, you know, waterfalls and ruins everything, right? Because if you don't, come 8:45, the restaurant owner's back there and now he's yelling because of the waiters are yelling and he's having to comp food because it was either cold or was wrong or stuff like that. That's when it gets bad, right? That's your outage, right? So what you're doing is you're looking for anomalies and stuff like that. It's like, hey, man, you know, John on the fry, he's not doing too good today. Let me go and help him out. Let me go drop a couple things like that. And you start multitasking. You pull somebody in to do expo so we can do stuff like that. And that's how you do. You have to recognize these things. You have to recognize when things aren't right before it gets bad. And that's the only way it's going to operate smoothly.
And if you think about prep, right? Let's talk about that. It's almost very, very similar to, like, I don't know, if your observability and you're doing like alerts and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. If you don't have the right alerts in place, right? Or you don't have the right prep in place and you have to cover X amount of meals for the night of my specials and we're doing swordfish tonight and all this other fun stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like that parallel that you drew is fantastic. Fantastic,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Somebody's meals is like, that is their, they're literally going to die by it, right? That means I'm plump, right? I have my towels here. I've got my knives here. I got my sharpener there. I got my marker, got my pen, got my, you know, my sheet of where everything is in the low boy, you know, how much stuff we have of what, you know, my oils, my pre-cut this, my pre-cut that, you know, everything's pans ready. Like it's gotta be set. And if it's off, I'm fucked up the rest of the night. Like if somebody comes and messes with my stuff, I'm screwed, right? Even if I get through it, I'm not happy about it, right? And I'm all irritable because like my stuff isn't right. You know, if I don't have my towels, if I don't have like that, you know? And so everyone becomes very particular. But the cool part about me is if you do it right, you can figure it out. If I have to step in somebody's station, I can see where everything is. Now, I'm not as efficient as they are, but everything is where it should be. And the other thing that you want to do is you always want to make sure you have a card that says, hey, how much of something is, because you can't memorize that when you're doing stuff, right? So if I open the low boy and I take out a fish, I'm going to look at it. All right, we have two left, right? Because I know I put five in there and I've already done two, right? Or I've already done three, so I know I have two left.
Can you tell people what a low boy, I know what it is, but what is a low boy? Oh,
a low boy is the refrigeration unit that's underneath the counter, right? So you reach under it to open the stuff up. So when you reach in the low boy and you pull out something, I would always keep a card there so I could indicate how much was on there. So if somebody says, hey, how many tunas do we have? Two all day, right? And then put it back in there and then close the door. Because if I try and memorize, if I get that count wrong, right? And I say three and we only had two, right? That waiter is going to go put in an order for the last one. It's not going to be there, right? And now I messed up. That's called documentation.
Great. Oh man, this interview is just went the completely different direction I expected to, and I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
So now look, okay. So again, this education we got, it, you know, being a chef, being a line chef and being executive chef and all these things prepared you, right? Let's talk about getting into the tech world. Talk about where you first, you know, you did the tech thing before. What made you come back? Were you like, you know, I need a change? Talk to me about that.
Well, no, it was the recession of 2008. Right.
Oh,
when I was an executive chef, I left executive chef to become a sous chef for someone who I had sous chef for before, because I love working with her. It was awesome. And then the recession hit and she was like, I've got to cut people. Right. And I was like, well, I have other skill sets, right, that I can leverage. And some of these folks, like, this is all they know, you know? So I was like, yeah, I can go find. So I went, I left, I looked for the jobs, interviewed and got picked up as tech support at a hosting company in Virginia Beach. And then left the cooking world to go for that and became tech support. Went from tech support L1 to L2 to supervisor to systems admin to L2 systems admin. And mind you, the difference between at the time, because this was Virginia, the difference between an L1 tech support and an L2 systems admin was $3 an hour. That was it. So I was still in Virginia Beach at the time, and I got poached by a rival hosting company who was going to double my salary if I moved to Austin, Texas. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Gotcha. And so, again, preparing you for this, now you're in a role. To explain to me your role now with Equinix Metal, formerly Packet.
Yeah, so I'm a principal solutions architect. It's my actually first foray into pre-sales officially, although as a technical account manager and even as a senior SRE and senior DevOps engineer, I still did a lot of talking to customers because I feel like engineers need that kind of context to actually understand the customer use cases, understand the customers themselves. So I'm over there as a principal solutions architect. I keep saying principal because it's my first principal role and I fucking earned it. So I'm going to keep saying it.
You deserve it, man.
I'm going to start like busting here. Actually, I say it, but it is true that I deserve it because I know I've done the work. It's just hard for me to recognize sometimes, right? But I'm getting better at that.
Why is that? Like, look, no, let's double click on that. And I follow you. We've talked about this at length in terms of like, you know, I feel like you should be your own biggest fan as much as we all are. Every time I look at you, every time I see you interacting with people, you are efficient with your words. You're phenomenal. You're intelligent. You're brilliant. Why do you do that to yourself? Talk to me about that.
Oh, man. Because, all right, so there's a few things, right? And we really want to get into it, right? So the in this country, right, especially in the South, right, it has been dangerous for Black men to be sure of themselves. It has been dangerous for Black men to have an ego. It has been dangerous for Black men to show pride, right? We're uppity. We're troublesome, right? They've turned my predecessors into Christmas tree ornaments for less, right? So that stuff gets carried down, right? It gets carried down like, hey, you know, my dad, you know, up until the point where he was in college at an HBCU, he couldn't really look white people in the eye. Right? Couldn't do that. Nope. What are you looking at me, boy? Right? And so like, even if you don't mean to pass that on, you still have to unlearn that yourself. Otherwise your kids are going to catch onto it. Right? So that's part of it. Right? Then there's just the general standard, low self-esteem issues caused by being a kid with ADHD. Right. You know, because you're like, oh, man, I don't know why I can't pay attention. This stuff is not working out for me. Like, I have a hard time doing this. And, you know, even if you intellectually understand what the condition is and what it does, you still have to deal with that. You still have to deal with that kind of baggage that goes along with it. You know what I mean? And so, you carry it with you and it's hard to deal with. And when you're now like, I'm 45 and I'm going through like, and I've been in therapy and stuff like that. And they'll say like, hey, you know, say something nice about yourself. And I fucking bust out into tears, right? Cause it's hard, right? And, you know, and some of that too, I will say for honest, a lot of that too is just being a dude, right? Being a man, we're supposed to have a very, you know, the manly, you know, toxic man has a very narrow emotional bandwidth that he's supposed to display and not real happy. You know, they tend to be okay with some bouts of rage, but being very vulnerable, right, isn't a thing that we're supposed to, that culturally that we're real big on, right? And so coming to terms with some of those things that cause that kind of embarrassed reaction when I have to compliment myself involves being vulnerable and talking about some of this shit, right? And we're not supposed to do that, right? Black men aren't supposed to be on, you know, depression meds or anxiety meds or anything like that. Like that's weakness, right? And that's not been real. That's been hard for us to accept as a culture. And I think, and one of the things that I've tried to do is to show people, men of color, like get therapy, right? If you are a man in this country, especially if you're a Black man in this country, you fucking need therapy, right? No ifs, ands, or buts. You need to talk about it. Because there's some stuff that I haven't even realized that. for me to say that I have, you know, generational trauma has taken a while for me to identify these things and say, well, that's what it is, right? Like for me, like I didn't even know I had anxiety until like earlier this year. I just thought that was normal. I thought everybody worried like I did, like, you know, have all this like that, you know, tickles when I get like my pulse goes up just when you talk about some stuff. Like I thought that was normal. I'm like, no, man, you've got anxiety. I'm like, oh, is that what that is? Like, so.
And you know, people say, oh, you can snap out of it. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, you can snap out of that. And, you know, well, you know, I agree in terms of the therapy aspect of it. It is something that, like, you know, and again, I don't know, you know, that struggle. I don't have that specific struggle, but in, you know, in terms of, you know, others I know who have went through it, it's a tough thing. It's, yeah, you know, because you also look at yourself as no matter what you do. And again, like you said earlier, you don't think you amount to it. And, oh, you know, I have ADHD or whatever you do, you know, it's like, I don't think, you know, all my thoughts aren't, you know, together to be able to do that. Then I see you and I see, again, you know, I look at your tweets and it was like, oh, you know, I see you literally brutalizing something in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, like just, you know, practicing sparring and doing all these things. Yeah. And then like literally the next day, I don't feel sure of myself. And I look at it and I'm like, God, I just want to reach out and be like, dude, you're fucking awesome.
The hard part is for me is that I do these things because I enjoy doing them, right? Just to talk about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, is like that is one of the few times I can single thread, right? And for me, being someone who has ADHD, single threading is fucking hard. And when I do it, it is so relaxing. It is so relaxing when I can be really in the moment, when I can say, all right, this is my only concern. Right now, my only concern is keeping this man from choking me to death with my own clothes, right? Okay, that's the only thing I'm thinking about. And it's lovely. Like, you know, I don't care if he sweats in my mouth because he's going to sweat in my mouth, right? You know, I don't care if this hurts a little bit because it's going to hurt a little bit. That's fine because it's the only thing I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about my job. I'm not thinking about the bills. I'm not thinking about the kids. I'm not thinking about relationships. I'm not thinking about any of that stuff. I'm thinking about how to get this motherfucker's knee off my belly. And it's great. And that lasts for a while. And then like you get off the mat, you change your clothes, right? And then the world starts to come back. The threads start to spin up. They come out of zombie mode. And then you're like, oh, now it's loud again, right? But for that time that I'm doing that, that's just the one thing. And it's amazing, right? But when I do that, I do that for that reason. And I'm good at it, right? I can objectively say I'm good at it. And I'm going to stop myself from qualifying that, because that's my natural instinct is to do that. But the problem is that like when I would win something, right? When I won American Nationals, which after I'd already won Pan Ams, I was like, my professor got mad at me because I didn't celebrate. Because I don't know how to celebrate. Like I do not know how to celebrate my own accomplishments. Don't know how to do it. Like I just raise my hand, check my opponent. Hey, you good? All right, man. Hey, yeah. All right. Go get my picture taken. I smile, but I don't celebrate. Like, I don't know how to do it. Like, you know, I've got a wonderful, wonderful fucking partner, right? She is amazing. And here's why, because when I got like my job, this job at Packet, I've been interviewing for the job at Equinix Metal, I've been going for, you know, for a while. She was like, we're going to celebrate you having this job. And I'm like, you mean celebrate having a job? Like, no, you're going to do something nice because you got this job. And she was firm about it. And fucking, we had a little, you know, got myself, you know, nice beer, a steak, and like that to celebrate. And like, that's a start, right? But it's hard still for me to look at something I have done and say, that is good without detaching myself from it, right? And the second that I attach to myself, I still get that anxiety. I still get that I have to qualify. I still get that, hey, all right, well, let's not go too far because you don't want to sound cocky. You know, like my humility is not an act. All right. It is not. That is how it is. It is hard for me to, but you know, if you push the right button though, I'll tell you about yourself. Right. And that's where the thing is, like, there are things that I've done the work for that if you try and say, I haven't done the work for, I'm going to show you receipts. Right. And that's how you get it. And that's the other side of the coin. Like there are reasons that I now have to keep, you know, a scrapbook of things that I've done, right? Things that people have said about accomplishments I've done. And I encourage everyone to do this, right? Because when I'm feeling shitty, when I'm feeling like I'm nothing, I'll go back and look at that book now and be like, no, I did that. Yeah, I did that. No, I did that too. I did that too. Right. And that's important, right? Especially nowadays when freaking this pandemic has been awful for people, right? And a lot of us are down the top, especially if you're by yourself. Like I'm, you know, when you don't have anyone else around you and you're starting to feel like you probably need something to pull yourself out sometimes, whether it's imposter syndrome, whether it's being lonely, whether it's anxiety or depression, you need, you know, you can throw up your hand and ask for help, but you also need to have some stuff where you can help yourself, right? So future Tim is grateful to past him for writing down some of the things I've done. That way, when I can go into these discussions with people who are trying to pay my company a lot of money, I can remind myself that I am competent, that I got this job because I know what the fuck I'm doing.
No doubt. And one of the things I think you and I bonded over, we talked about this a little bit, is just, you know, body perception, right? In terms of like, you know, dysmorphia and stuff like this. And it's like, again, you know, I came from a place I was up 100 pounds, right? And so, and I lost that weight, and like, still sometimes I look at myself, I'm like, oh, you know what? You still are that big person.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
you see the person you were before, right?
Yeah.
And again, no, you know, to like, it's a struggle every, you know, sure, it's a struggle every day. You know, we do what we have to do, but, and we were talking about it, and it was like, man, like, and I look at you and you're like, this dude just posts pictures. He gives zero shits. He's like, this is me, take it or leave it. And I fucking love you for it, man.
It's taken me a long time to get there. Like a long, long time to get there. You know, I was a, you know, aside from being in the Marine, I was a chunky kid, not fat, right? Chunky kid in high school, joined the Marine Corps. I was an Adonis, right? You know, 225 pounds, 6% body fat at my biggest. You know, nothing but muscle, you know, ran all the time, would eat 4,000 calories a day to avoid losing weight. And then I got out of the Marine Corps and, you know, you get used to eating 4,000 calories a day, but I wasn't running no more. And I gained weight. I got up to, I think the biggest I ever was before I started jiu-jitsu was like 315. Right.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'8".
Okay. Wow, man. Yeah.
Hated myself, hated everything about myself, had zero, like the only thing I had was like the things I could, you know, I really didn't have nothing. If I'm being honest, like nothing to which I would hang my hat on and say I'm good at, despite having been good at my job, sweat, all this stuff. I didn't see that. I just look in the mirror, fucking hated myself. Right. Started jiu-jitsu, lost 100-ish pounds, you know, like at my smallest, when I was weight cutting, I was about 100 pounds. That's what I'd, you know, get down to 215 or so. I'd walk around at 230. And you know, COVID, I got back up to like 255 and now I'm back down to like mid 230s. But you know, was weightlifting, I was doing jiu-jitsu, and my body in my life, my body has done some amazing things. Right. But it's hard for me to see that when I look in the mirror, I see stretch marks, I see, you know, man boobs. You know, it doesn't matter that underneath these man boobs are, you know, chest and traps and pecs that will, you know, bench press 400 pounds, you know, deadlift, you know, almost 500. I don't see that. Right. So I have to, like, even when I do it, I feel good about it. And I have to video myself when I do these things, when I do my PRs, so that I can go back. It's my receipts, right? My scrapbook. So go back and look at that. Right. My body's done amazing things as I was in the military. It's literally an actual killing machine now, you know, if I wanted it to be. But sometimes I don't see that when I look in the mirror, man. I just see this old fat guy, you know, and it's hard, right? It's hard. 'Cause you know, it's like, you know, that's that kid, that person that I hated all those times. And even when, you know, even when, like I look at myself in the mirror, I'll catch myself in the mirror when I'm not thinking about it. And I'm like, who the fuck is that? That dude's got big arms and like big traps. It's like a good looking guy, you know, like, and then like, I'm for a second, I see it. I'm like, that's great. And then like the rest of the time, it's like, meh, you know? And so again, I was going to talk to my partner because she's done some things. Like she has just taken pictures of me, right? That I don't recognize myself in. Because I look fucking good, right? And it's weird for me to see when I'm getting, because, you know, my ex never really took pictures of me, right? In the 21 years we're together, you know, some, and the ones she took, I look, I like myself in, right? But when someone takes a picture of someone when they are being themselves, when they are being happy, when they are just genuinely expressing themselves, right? That's a different person than the person they're looking at in the mirror, right? When someone looks in the mirror, they're looking at themselves and they see themselves the way they think they are, right? And that doesn't necessarily match up to the way they actually are or the way to others. And so when I see myself the way that others see me, it's life-changing, you know, and not in the bad way. Like, 'cause I don't surround myself with shitty people anymore. I don't have time for that. Not I'm 45. I don't have time for that anymore. And so like, when I put people in my life, I've made the effort, number one, to be the person that I want to be. And it's been a lot of work, both physically and mentally. Right. It's a lot of work going to therapy, really dealing with some of my shit, you know, holding myself accountable for, you know, a person who I was and trying to be, you know, go be the person I want to be, you know, doing the work physically, and getting there and right. And being okay with the person who I am on paper. Right. If I write down what I've done, I'm happy about that. But also like having people around you that really see you, right. It makes a difference. And it's not that I need external validation, you know, it's not that I need it to an extent. I think we all need it. Sometimes we all need to be checked, right? Especially if we're dysmorphic and we don't see ourselves. Sometimes I don't believe it, even when people tell me, but when I can see it for myself, like even just a fucking glimmer, when I can just see a fucking glimmer of it, man.
Sometimes you want to post like a picture and sometimes mm-hmm. it's not so much like, hey, look at me. It's more like, fuck you. I did this.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, what I'm saying? Like, you know, I'm guilty of the gym selfie. I don't care. I'll do it, but guess what? I'm going to do it. I don't care.
Yeah, because I did the work, right? And
yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing. It is so important, right? I didn't get this 5 years ago. I didn't get this when people were like, I'm feeling myself post picture. Like, I didn't get it, right? Because I never felt myself. And so when I'm feeling it, I'm going to put it up there, right? Because it's my fucking receipts.
Yep.
It is me. I feel good about myself. I look good. I'm happy about it. And I want to share it with the world, but also I'm going to share it with myself. Right? My arms look good. Boy, I'm going to put that up there, man. If I, you know, get tans pumped, yeah, let me post a little thirst trap so you can see these, right? You know, if I'm holding a small dog and, you know, my arms look big, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to put that up there, right?
That's great.
And I think we can just to put a button on it, right?
Yep.
It's meant like, please celebrate yourselves, right? Celebrate not as like, you know, I bought a car, a house, like all these accomplishments that don't really mean anything, right? Take the time, like, fellas, to really, like, look at yourself and say, hey, man, like, I like who I am. I like what I've done, like, and I want to celebrate myself. And if you can't do that, right, there's a few, talk to somebody, go to a therapist, and then look at your life, right? Sometimes if you don't feel that about yourself, it's because you're not doing the things to feel that, right? And you need to change, right? But that change is critical, because if you don't like yourself, right, despite all, you know, if you take an honest inventory of what you are doing, and who you are, and you don't like yourself, how do you think other people feel about you?
Sivo is an alternative to the big hyperscale cloud providers. They've launched the world's first managed Kubernetes service powered exclusively by K3S. With sub-90-second cluster launch times, a simplified Kubernetes experience, and predictable billing, Sivo is on a mission to create a better developer experience. Get $250 free credit to get started. Sign up today at sivocloud.com/podcast. That's CIVO.com/podcast. Go check them out. So we talked a little bit about Kubernetes, but I want to talk about this. So there was the Kubernetes contributor experience, and there was the bake-off. And that, again, like I knew you before, and I was like, this is Tim's like coming out party to the Kubernetes community. I'm like, this guy is, I was live tweeting while you were doing it, but tell everybody the line. It's the greatest line ever. Like, oh, yeah. So wait, let me set the story here. Yeah. So it's the bake-off, and I'm going to put a link to it, you all, because it's everybody, like, you know, it's Kat, it's Augustus, it's you, literally like owning it, right? And so, it, you know, like in terms of the commentary, but everybody, like all the folks were doing like this bake-off, like the Great British Bake-Off, it was a knock, you know, that, you know, it was a effectively that. And like the commentary, Tim, give me the line, dude, it's so good.
But how does it pair with bourbon?
every single dessert that Light came up. It was amazing, man. And I'm just crying. I'm literally crying. I'm laughing so hard.
They're like, oh, wow, that looks real neat. It's marshmallow. Well, but how does it pair with bourbon? Right? But I'll say this. Like, I had to do something because here's like, Kat Cosgrove will command any room that she's in and okay. some that she's not, right? So like having to try to come up to match her level, man, I had to do something. I had to pull something out. She is the best. Like I would do, it doesn't matter. If it was a phone book reading with Kat Cosgrove, I'm going to do it. I've done a couple podcasts, a couple live streams with her. She is the best. I love her.
She's magic. And she's been on the show and it's been phenomenal. But dude, like I said, Ed, totally with just owning it, man. I was like, this dude, this is his coming out party, man. Everybody should like look at this dude just work, man. It was great.
It's what I love. This is the part. Okay. So I've never gone to a conference for technical content. Not once, right? I think I see those talks later on. I don't care. But pretty much they're all rehashing the same stuff. The point is to see the people. The people are what's important. Right? In tech and anything else, the people are what's important. So the people are what's important. And that's who I want to be with. I don't APIs or, you know, coding language, you know, doesn't matter. All right. That stuff, that's, you know, tangential, right? To, I think, an industry. You take care of the people, you learn the people, you know, the people, you get to be friends with the people, you know, understand where they come from, have fun with them. Good stuff is going to come out of it. Right. Not anyone, because everyone has their own motivations. But for me, and I think a lot of people like that, I don't come in this just to be the smartest person, right? I don't come in here to say I'm the best coder, right? Because I'm not. I'm not the best coder. I'm a terrible coder. I'm a good enough coder, right? I code like Beyonce sings. I said it. but it's not, I'm not here for that. I'm here because I want to feed my family and make friends. That's it.
Well, Tim.
I can't wait for the hate mail.
Somebody talking shit about Queen B.
Oh yeah, yeah. And, I'm in Texas, boy. She's, you know, Houston ain't that far away. I know I'm going to hear from it.
All right, so Tim, last question for you: what work in your career are you most proud of?
I am most proud of being able to advocate for women, right? Because I've said it before, I may be black, but I'm still a man, right? And I've seen too many times in meetings where a woman will say something and she'll just get run over. Someone else will say the same thing, they don't get traction, right? And, you know, before I really felt confident in myself and my abilities, I would just let it go because I didn't want to rock the boat. But fuck that. You know, and so being able to not, I don't need to elevate these people because they're fucking brilliant, right? I just need to let them be heard and to let their accomplishments speak for themselves, right? And so the times that I've been able to do that, the times when I've been able to leverage my personal, my career, whatever capital that I need to be able to say, you shut up and listen to her. Right. That's the stuff I'm proudest of. Because like I said, like I don't care about patents. I don't care about, you know, CVEs. I don't care about, you know, being an alpha nerd. I don't care about alpha nerds. Right. I will sweep floors if I can make the money I'm making now. I don't care about any of that. Right. It's the people that are important.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for being on the podcast, man.
Guys, I appreciate it. We got to do this again. Anytime,
man.
All right, my friend.